You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
It's been 2.5 years since the Boko Haram kidnappings of 276 schoolgirls in the Nigerian city of Chibok. For his latest book, The Chibok Girls, The Boko Haram Kidnappings and Islamist Militancy in Nigeria, Hilan Habila traveled back to his home country to visit the site of the kidnappings. He also went into the heartland of Boko Haram. The book is published by Columbia Global Reports, and I'm very pleased to welcome Hilan Habila to our show today. Hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
You're known as a poet and a writer of fiction. What led you to venture into the world of nonfiction?
Well, I was also a journalist in my former life. I worked as a journalist in Lagos in around 1999, 2000. So I thought that, you know, with this subject matter, I wanted to do journalism. You know, sometimes you realize that fiction has its limitations. And I think when you want to say something directly without any ambiguity, best way to do it is through nonfiction. That's why I kind of chose that medium.
How and when did Boko Haram originate, and where does its name come from?
The two words, Boko Haram, they're a mixture of the Hausa, that's a Nigerian language, that's where Boko comes from. Boko means book or Western education. And Haram is from the Arabic, meaning something that is forbidden. So Boko Haram simply means Western education is forbidden, and that kind of talks about the ideology of that group.
And the Hausa people are mostly Muslim?
Mostly, predominantly Muslim, yeah, in northern Nigeria, yeah.
Tell us about Muhammad Yusuf, the creator of Boko Haram. Didn't he get his ideology from a previous group, the Nigerian Taliban?
Yes. Muhammad Yusuf, that's the charismatic founder of the Boko Haram group, even before they were called that name. And the group kind of originated around 2002, 2000 in Maiduguri, that's the northeastern part of Nigeria. And they call themselves the Taliban, and they basically sympathize with the Taliban ideology. They kind of removed themselves from society and moved to this remote area in northern part of Borno State, and basically tried to live under the Sharia rule. They turned their back on democracy, on the government, from society, and said that they will only live under Islamic law. So that's really how the group started.
But that wasn't enough. They could have just remained an isolated group. What led them to do the things that they have become infamous for?
Yeah, I think they started to have conflicts with the government, because basically when you challenge the government, that was like challenging the government. They said that they didn't recognize the government, they didn't recognize democracy, and they started to invade police stations and prisons, started arming themselves. So I think the government was alarmed by what was happening, and some of them were arrested. Yeah.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Gombe State, Gombe Town, Gombe State, this northeastern Nigeria, the same area we're talking about where Boko Haram came.
So you might have even known some of the people who later joined the group?
Yeah, here and there, definitely.
Yeah. Hasn't Boko Haram moved into neighboring countries? Is its focus still Nigeria?
Boko Haram currently operates in three countries, Nigeria, Niger, and Cameroon, because the state of Borno, where Boko Haram originates, is on the border with these two countries. So it's so easy for them to move across borders, and that made it so hard for the government to fight them, because they usually kind of escape across the border when they're being attacked.
There's a geographical split between Muslims and Christians in Nigeria. Muslims mostly in the north, Christians in the south. The country's split pretty much 50-50?
Pretty much, though this is often kind of an oversimplification. You know, we tend to say that, you know, Muslim north, Christian south. But even in the north, you have pockets of Christianity. For instance, I'm from the north, I'm a Christian. And there are lots of southerners like the Yorubas who are also Muslims. So it's a complicated country. This is a country of about 200 million people with over 300 ethnic groups and, you know, inclinations. And
so it's just a construct that grew out of British colonialism.
Exactly.
Stick a whole bunch of people together, put a border around it, and call it a country.
That's exactly the problem and, you know, the idea with Nigeria. This is a typical post-colonial country yoked together by this British power that, you know, for so many reasons, for its, you know, exploitative reasons. And then they are left in this country to make it work, you know, to form a country from these diverse groups.
Didn't Muslims claim that they had been discriminated against by the Christians, which was a legacy of British colonial days?
There is that. You know, it's sometimes Christians say that they're discriminated against when you have a Muslim president. And then when you have a Christian president, Muslims say they are discriminated against. So it's like a game of blackmail. You know, you tend to, you know, claim that you're being sidelined so that you get more attention, basically. That's always been the game with Nigerian.
Well, after independence, affirmative action was imposed so that Muslims could overcome some of the things that had kept them perhaps a bit more backward. But that doesn't, has that worked at all?
That hasn't really worked. What happened is that the Muslim part, the northern part, was a bit behind in terms of Western education, because the missionaries, when they came, they settled in the southern parts first, and they started schools and, you know, missions. And so there was kind of a spread of Western education there. But the northern part deliberately resisted the encroachment of Christianity because they wanted to have only Islamic education, you know, practiced. So that kind of worked against them. And later they realized that, and they wanted things to kind of change. But it's a bit late. So they're still trying to catch up in so many ways. And for some reasons, you could say that that's really why things like Boko Haram could happen there, because of the lack of education, relative poverty compared to the South, and so many factors leading to that.
My guest is Helan Habila, an award-winning author and associate professor of creative writing at George Mason University. His latest book, The Chibok Girls, The Boko Haram Kidnappings and Islamist Militancy in Nigeria. As of 2012, all 12 northern states of Nigeria have declared Sharia as the official state law. What does that mean for the Christians who live up there?
Yes, people like me. It means that you have to basically live the best way you can under that kind of system. Even though when the Christians complained, the governors who introduced the Sharia said that, you know, this is just for Muslims. It's not going to affect you. But of course it's going to affect you, because, you know, there will be no beer parlors. There will be no hotels and things like that. All the service industry would be affected, which is, you know, mostly run by Christians. So Christians were affected, and they're still being affected, and there's no two way about it. Yeah.
And what would Sharia law have imposed that would be different from the other laws of Nigeria?
The Sharia law usually tries to adhere to the Quran, you know, the teachings and the strictures in the Quran. And but the main thing is political. It's like a kind of struggle for power. If we don't recognize Western education, then the power goes to the Islamic rulers and leaders, and that kind of makes them more relevant in the society. So it's kind of political, also religious.
And as you point out, the name Boko Haram suggests a rejection of Western ideas, Western education.
Correct.
When did Boko Haram start launching its attacks?
This was after the death of Mohammed Yusuf, the founder of the group. He was killed by the military in 2009, and the group was, you know, disbanded. Their mosque, their place of worship was destroyed by the government. They went underground for about 6 months, 1 year. So in 2010, that was when they came back under a new leader. His name is Abubakar Shekau, who is a bit different from Mohammed Yusuf. He's more aggressive. He's more confrontational, and he believes more in in fighting the government. So that's really when they started attacking police stations and kidnapping people and really attacking.
But this is before the creation of ISIS, although I guess those certain attitudes were in the air in different parts of the Islamic world. Mm-hmm. But didn't it take 2 years for the U.S. State Department to place Boko Haram on the list of foreign terrorist organizations?
Yes.
Why so long, despite the fact that it was engaged in obvious terrorist activities?
So many reasons. And I think one of the main reasons was the reluctance of the former government of Nigeria under Goodluck Jonathan to really look for cooperations and to kind of work with foreign organizations who offered to work with the government, but he was a bit reluctant. And that discouraged a lot of them from working with the Nigerian government. And so the American government didn't really declare Boko Haram a foreign terrorist organization until
Nigerian government that. Is notorious for corruption. Does it make that kind of cooperation more difficult?
I guess so. It does in so many ways, because we're talking about a lot of money. We're talking about arms being purchased. We're talking about movement of money transfer across Nigeria and other countries. So all these things would be affected if the organization had been declared FTO. So those are some of the implications, I think, that affected Jonathan's decision.
Although your book addresses the history of Islamic militancy in Nigeria, its focus is on the Chibok girls. It's been almost 2.5 years since those kidnappings. What happened on the day of April 2014? These weren't the first kidnappings of girls.
Yes, there were kidnappings before April 2014. But that was the, I think, most symbolic one, because 276 girls were taken from their school dormitories at night by Boko Haram militants.
That was the largest mass kidnapping they had engaged in?
Yeah, in one group, at least of schoolgirls. And what makes it more important is that those were schoolgirls living under the government's protection. So they were taken from the government directly. So the government kind of dropped the ball in that sense. So that makes it more important for the Boko Haram to use them as, a kind of propaganda tools, because they took them from the government.
You visited Chibok. How hard is it to get there? You've described it as perhaps the poorest and most neglected of all 27 local governments in Borno State.
Yeah, it's a sad little place, really desolate. And you can tell, you can feel the sadness of the people and the parents because of what had happened to them.
Were you welcomed?
I was welcomed. Like I said, I'm from that part of the world generally, and I could speak the language, and I was able to talk to them. And they were quite willing to talk to me because they want their story to be heard. They want to keep this topic in the forefront all the time, because it's so easy to forget about the girls and kind of move on to the next thing. And so they were quite happy to talk to me.
But weren't you afraid they weren't going to let you in at first?
Yes. The place is in a lockdown. There's a huge detachment of military protecting and kind of letting... I'm stopping people from entering, especially journalists. So it was a bit hard for me to go in. I guess I was lucky. I was able to get in. A lot of journalists were turned back.
It did help, as you say, that you spoke the language and you're from the area.
Correct, yeah.
My guest is Helen Habila. His latest book, The Chibok Girls, The Boko Haram Kidnappings and Islamist Militancy in Nigeria. It's published by Columbia Global Reports, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Helen Habila. His latest book is The Chibok Girls, The Boko Haram Kidnappings and Islamist Militancy in Nigeria, published by Columbia Global Reports. You spoke to a number of people in Chibok. Who were some of them, and how were they affected by the kidnappings?
Yeah, I tried to speak to a kind of as wide a range of people as I could, and some of them were there's a mother whose daughter was taken. I was able to talk to her, and she kind of narrated to me what happened, took me kind of step by step about that night when the girls were taken. I also talked to a pastor in Chibok who told me also about his experience. He also has his nieces taken that night, two of them. And I also talked to the chief imam, the Islamic head in Chibok. So I kind of got different versions, and but all about that night, how it happened.
Was this a generally peaceful city, or had there been a lot of violence before?
There has been a lot of violence, political violence. You know, there have been political killings and assassinations. It's such a small town, about 60,000. The whole local government is about 60,000 people, but there's a lot happening. But mostly it's a town of farmers and civil servants.
And what's the significance of targeting the girls? Is one of the reasons for the kidnapping the Boko Haram position on education for women?
Yes. Like I said, Boko Haram means Western education is taboo. So
education for anyone?
Education for anyone, but especially for girls, because of the significance of girls. Girls are the future. So if you discourage girls from going to school, if you kidnap them, if you terrorize them, that means you're destroying education because their children will not be educated. So they are quite aware of that. So they target girls, especially to kind of harass and discourage.
And didn't a number of the girls manage to escape right from the start?
Yes, about 57 of them were able to jump off the trucks that night when they were being taken. And I talked to about three of them in my book.
What had happened to them?
It's just so sad, you know, when they were taken out because the insurgents came dressed in military uniform. So the girls thought that they were soldiers there to protect them. And they were able to get the girls to go out of their school compounds and into the trucks. And that was when they realized that these are not soldiers, they are the terrorists. And some of them, you know, decided to brave it and jump off the trucks. Some of them broke their legs. Some of them, you know, were thrown back into the trucks by the soldier, by the insurgents. So about 57 were able to escape that night and went back to their parents. And some of them, you know, are back in school. Some of them are, you know, some of them are married now. Some of them, you know, I was able to talk to some of them.
And some of them are in the United States.
Yes, about 10, 15 of them were brought here by an organization to continue their education. And some of them are in Virginia, other states.
And are they happy here? How are they treated? And who are they living with?
They are living with an NGO. It's called the Education Must Continue Initiative. This the NGO that kind of worked to get them there in collaboration with some members of Congress in America.
One of the people you write about is Emmanuel Ogebe.
Yes. I met him. He lives in Virginia. And, you know, I live in Virginia as well. And I was surprised to discover him there. And he is the one that is responsible for bringing about 10 of them initially. And I talked to him.
And he accuses the United States of, quote, inadvertently aiding Boko Haram by not selling arms to the Nigerian government. But the Nigerian government has also used its military to go after other people in the country, especially when it's over who owns oil rights.
Yes. I guess the point he was making was that, you know, there was a reluctance by the American government at that time to sell arms to the Nigerian government because of all the questionable things that you just mentioned, you know, the kind of misuse of the military against civilians. So that was the reservation that the American government had. And Ogebe was, you know, kind of saying that you should just forget about that and sell arms to the military so that they can fight Boko Haram because, as it is, Boko Haram is winning the war.
But we mentioned corruption in the government, and corruption may have even affected ransom negotiations for the girls.
Yes. I talked about that in my book, and
that's how I know about it.
Different instances of you know, where money was given to individuals to negotiate and kind of pay ransom for these girls to negotiate with Boko Haram, and the money ended up in their pockets. A lot of money, for instance, was stolen by the Suki, allegedly, you know, billions of dollars, money that was meant for the purchase of weapons, you know, helicopters to fight Boko Haram, and it never happened.
Didn't President Goodluck Jonathan's administration deny that the Chibok kidnappings even took place?
Yes, yes, he did.
How could they do that?
At a point, he did. He refused to meet the parents. He refused to meet the family. He said that it was his political enemies that were kind of manufacturing these stories to make him look bad in the, you know, international media. And that was his thinking. So that really explains why there was so much slow progress at the beginning, you know. And 3 years now, the guards are still there because the government didn't do enough at this initial
stage.
Did
that hurt him in the presidential elections that followed?
I think that's why he lost the election, because he lost the election in 2015. Despite his effort, despite postponing the elections, when he realized that people were not happy with him, that people really wanted action on Boko Haram. And then the new president, the one that got elected, Muhammadu Buhari, actually got elected because on the promise of fighting Boko Haram and doing something about the Chibok girls in particular.
Has he been more effective?
So far, he has been more effective than Jonathan. He's managed to push back Boko Haram because they were controlling a huge swath of land in Borno State, and he was able to take some of the land back. And some of the girls are actually being released because of negotiations between, I think, government and Boko Haram.
What about the governments of the other countries that Boko Haram is in? Have Cameroon gone after them?
Yes, Cameroon and Niger. Mm-hmm. So there is this international coalition of forces between the three countries, and they're kind of a joint task force fighting Boko Haram around the borders. So there's been cooperation between them to close the borders, you know, to cut off the logistics of Boko Haram, because they used to transport, you know, supplies across the borders and to move hostages across the borders, and that cooperation is kind of helping.
I'm speaking with Helan Habila. His latest book, The Chibok Girls, The Boko Haram Kidnappings and Islamist Militancy in Nigeria. It's published by Columbia Global Reports. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What happened to the Chibok girls who didn't escape? Weren't some of them used to commit acts of terrorism?
Yeah, they were being used by Boko Haram, you know, to commit, you know, suicide bombings.
Were they forced to become suicide bombers, or had they adopted the ideology of Boko Haram?
Well, we don't really know. We don't really know, but what we know is that some of them were used in that way. And some of them are married off to Boko Haram members. Some of them are dead, we believe, because that's what the Boko Haram spokesperson said in the last video that they released. They said about 40 of them have died in bombings, government bombings. And 21 of them were released in October, like I mentioned, because of negotiations between government.
And what happens when they return home? Are they treated as heroes or as tainted people?
Well, that's the next step now that, you know, the community that has to deal with and the government has to deal with. Well, there was a lot of jubilation and celebrations and church ceremonies when the 21 were released, you know. But then we hear the parents saying that, you know, they want the government to help them take the girls maybe to America or to England to educate them because of the stigma mm-hmm. that's attached to this. Most of them came back with children. They have babies from the terrorist husbands. So it's so complicated in this small society, small community. How do they go on after all this experience? It's difficult.
Haven't some of the women even asked to be returned to their kidnapper husbands?
Yes. Some of them are kind of sympathizing with their kidnappers, which is a classical case of the Stockholm syndrome. But, you know, these are 16, 17-year-old girls when they were taken, brutalized, brainwashed, you know, indoctrinated. So it's not surprising. I think it will take time before they kind of go back to being what they were before they were taken.
You visited Maiduguri, the heartland of Boko Haram. What did you find there?
Maiduguri is a very interesting place. Like I said, this is the hometown of Mohammed Yusuf. This is where Boko Haram started. And it's been a war zone for about 5-6 years now. And the effects, you know, you can see the effects of that war. The streets, you know, are kind of lined with IDP camps. These are internally displaced persons who are running away from Boko Haram in the villages and rural areas and kind of coming to the urban areas because that's where they can get protection. That's where they can get food. So we're talking about 2 million people displaced by this war that's been going on for 5 years, about 20,000 people killed. And you see the effects. You see the houses, you know, destroyed. You see the detention, and there's always curfew, you know, by 7 o'clock, the streets are empty. So you get a sense of that, even though there isn't a shooting war going on inside Maiduguri now, you can tell what has happened there, and the effects are kind of really visible.
Is that where some of the Chibok girls wound up?
Yes. One of them, about 2 months ago, was discovered accidentally in an IDP camp. You know, the soldiers were just carrying out routine, registration of the refugees. And they discovered one of the girls there with her child just in the camp. She had managed to escape on her own, and she was identified by them.
Hey, you spoke to 3 girls who escaped from the Chibok kidnapping. What was that like? Did they feel like they'd been damaged?
They are the ones that were lucky to have jumped off the tracks, so they weren't actually taken into the forest, and they didn't live with the terrorists like the other girls who are still there. What I got away from my interview with them is how determined they are, you know, to reject what Boko Haram wants, you know, them to become. You know, they are determined to go back to school, and they're actually in school now. They are determined to, you know, they told me they want to become doctors someday.
Are there opportunities for women who study medicine in that part of Nigeria? Or would they have to move to the south?
Well, there are universities in northeastern Nigeria, but I must say that is one of the least educated, you know, least developed educationally, when you're talking about education in all of Nigeria. And so it's not going to be easy for them to get that, get to that level that they want to go. But I think in a way the tragedy has its blessings, you know, in a disguise, because now they have more focus. People know about them and people are willing to help. So I guess they can do what they want to do if they really want it.
And Michelle Obama launched the hashtag Bring Back Our Girls campaign. Malala Yousafzai supported it. What have those kinds of efforts resulted in? Anything specific? Anything tangible?
Well, I guess the most tangible thing is the awareness, you know, by organizations around the world, people who wouldn't have ever had any reason to hear of Boko Haram. And the Chibok girls now know about them and their plight. And there are lots of international organizations in Nigeria, and I'm working with the government, trying to help the refugees, the internal displaced people, and also trying to lobby the government, to pressure the government to do something every day, to do something about, you know, getting the girls back home.
I would imagine that the families of these girls would want to leave their hometowns. Is that possible, or are they just too poor?
They are poor. They're just ordinary folk. These are, like I said, you know, farmers, you know, junior civil servants, teachers, and, you know, things like that. And they live there. This is their land. This is their home. And things like that happen. And I don't think they would kind of leave their home en masse because of that.
But you've reported that the parents of these kidnapped girls haven't all coped very well.
Yeah, it's been tragic. Some of them died, you know, some of them affected mentally because of that. So it's been a huge trial for them. But I am kind of glad to have met some of them who are really fighting to create awareness about the girls. They travel all over the country. They give speeches. They go on television. They go to meet the governors and the president, and they keep pushing, you know, trying to get results. So that is an admirable part of this thing. Yeah.
You're teaching creative writing at George Mason University. Now that you've written this book, are you going to go back to fiction and poetry, or do you see another work of journalism in the future?
I'm trying to finish a novel. Actually, I interrupted writing that novel just to write this one because I felt it was such a pressing subject matter that I wanted to address immediately. And I've done that. Now I'm going to go back to my novel and finish it, and some poetry maybe.
And we invite you back right now to talk about that novel whenever it's published. My great thanks to you for talking about this book. Hilan Habila's book is The Chibok Girls, The Boko Haram Kidnappings and Islamist Militancy in Nigeria. It is published by Columbia Global Reports. It's been a pleasure having you here.
Thank you for having me.